Good afternoon. I'm going to tell you a few words about Ajax. So since I work on Google Maps, and Google Maps has been quoted as the prototypical Ajax application, in general, quite wrongly so, because the technology is going is around for quite a longer while than Google Maps is. So since I work on that project, I have some exposure not only to the technologies behind it, but also to the hype in front of it. And I'm going to dissect this Ajax hype that came about during the last year a little bit. Okay, first for the name. So it has been mentioned already in talks before that Ajax is actually a quite horrible name. So it stands for Asynchronous JavaScript and XML. And all of these things are actually superfluous. So it was suggested to call it just A, and I would suggest to call it nothing of the three, because if we look at it, so all this Ajax stuff, as you of course know, is very much about user interaction. So it is basically the most important technology of this bunch of technologies and paradigms in this upcoming Web 2.0 that is most closely connected to the user experience. So as you all know, user-driven applications or interactive applications or the canonical architecture for interactive applications is event-driven. And events are handled asynchronously. So if you do any user or interactive application that is user-facing at all, then you do it asynchronously, of course. So there's nothing particular about doing it in this regard as well. JavaScript, the next thing, it was mentioned that there is VBScript, but really I don't think so. And then there is Flash. And inside Flash, there's also a scripting language called ActionScript, which is effectively JavaScript. I mean, it's not quite JavaScript, but it's quite similar. So effectively, you are programming JavaScript as well. So if you do something in script on the client side on the web, then you are doing JavaScript. You don't have any other choice. And XML is just superfluous, as has been mentioned. So, and it turns out that this name is really, really a bad name for it, but there are actually quite a few very important paradigm shifts, to be precise, associated with the introduction of this new architectural pattern or paradigm. And that is quite important. So, and as we've learned in the 90s, when this idea of design patterns came about, it is actually quite good to have a name for things that you talk about very often and that are very important for you. And so to have a bad name is still better than to have no name. And that's why I'm just going to stick with this Ajax name. Okay, so what is Ajax about from a high-level architectural perspective? So if you look at what you can by now call classical or classic web applications, right, which is quite ironic in itself given that the web is like 15 years old or so, and you already have a classic in that. But if you look at classic web applications, that is HTML pages that are sent to your browser by the server and on which you can click and maybe fill out forms and submit them. So then whatever happens on the client side is completely generic. There's nothing application specific that can ever happen on the client side. So whatever happens on the client side is results in just a request being sent to the server, and the server does the application specific stuff and just sends you back another document. And that's all there is. And in particular, no application-specific interaction logic is happening on the client, is the first thing. And whatever happens involves the refresh of the whole page. So you do something, and for doing that, you get a whole new page back from the server. So as you all know, there are two flavors of it. REST for representational state transfer means basically that the application state, the interaction state, is completely encoded in the URL of the page that you are looking at. And if you do a state transfer as a result for an interaction, you go to a document that comes from another URL. So that's REST. And the other thing, server-side session state is a variant of that, which means that what you get back from the server doesn't only depend on your request, but also depends on the state that is kept on the server, which is a very bad thing in itself, and I'm going to go back to that. In Ajax applications, on the contrary, there is a possibility by means of embedding script that is going to be executed on the client side in the HTML page to transfer part of the application logic, and particularly of the interaction part of the application logic, to the client side. And to do application-specific actions on the client side, which were in older applications and classic applications completely handled on the server side. So, and as a side remark, but I want to point out that I don't consider this particularly essential to it, these actions that are sent, whose implementations are sent to the client side and which are executed on the client side, may result in the transfer of additional data from the server to the client in the background, which data are then incorporated in the page, which is not being reloaded during that process as it was in older applications. So much for what happens in AJAX applications. I believe this mic is still on. That's just great, I guess. Okay, now this has two particularly important consequences. One consequence that is visible to the user for the UI, and one hidden consequence which I think is still more important. So the consequence for the UI is that actually sophisticated user interaction is now possible. That is, you can do something like folder hierarchies, tree widgets, drag and drop, and of course something like having a geographical map on the page, and you don't need to click on an arrow next to the map and get a new page with the same map on the page that is slightly offset to the direction in which this arrow pointed that you clicked on, but you can just take this map and drag it slightly in order to see what hasn't been visible before on this map. So on all these very natural effects are now, or user interaction modes are now possible in web pages. So which effectively means that you can now build web applications that are deployed into web browsers that have a user interaction like we've known them before the web was invented. So we can now build user interaction like in 1990, which is great. That's progress. And the other thing is that the state that is accumulated during user interaction, that is, for instance, the set of opened folders in a tree view of a folder hierarchy, or the particular area on the map that you are looking at and the zoom level and whatever is on the map, can now be accumulated on the client side. So that state can be stored into data structures that are held in memory on the client side as JavaScript data structures or as document object model data structures, because they are not wiped out every time you do something to the page, because the page is just not being reloaded. And that means that you don't need server-side session state anymore. And so server-side session state, if you remember, I hope you can remember that, how the HTTP protocol was originally specified is something very alien to the web. So the HTTP protocol is actually stateless. That is, the response to every request is entirely determined by the request and not by something transient maintained on the server. Of course, it depends on the data that are stored permanently on the server, but not on transient things like a login state or links I clicked before, or something like that. And the problem that arose, of course, was with more complex user interaction, the state grew more complex. So it was very tedious to encode the whole current session state or current user interaction state in the URL, which would be necessary, or actually in the HTTP request, but which means mostly in the URL, which would be necessary to maintain that statelessness of the HTTP protocol. And therefore, lazy software developers invented server-side session state. So now you have server-side session state, which means that you have an object on the server that maintains your current session state. And this object is invariably causing trouble in various respects. So first of all, in terms of user experience, it has to expire, and it expires always at the wrong time. So likely after a longer time, which means you've spent a longer time to actually do something useful on the client side without going back to the server, and if you submit that very long form, for instance, then your session is expired and your work of the last 5 minutes is lost, and so on. And it also scales very badly in the sense that you can't handle server-side session state very well on server farms of a multitude of servers. So it's all very well as long as you have one host that, that runs your server. But if you are going to scale that to multiple hosts, then you have to invent some kind of session affinity, and the session affinity is going to bust you if a host dies. So, I mean, you can make a session affine to a host, but if the host is going away, then this is bad. And if you do that for only one host, then it is very not very frequent that a host dies, but if you do it for many hosts, let's say, then it becomes more frequently that one of the hosts dies, and users invariably notice. Anyway, excuse my rant about server-side session state. The big thing about AJAX is that AJAX actually makes server-side session state superfluous because you can handle the transient elements of your interaction state on the client side. And that's actually a very good and aesthetically very pleasant and very satisfying aspect of this AJAX architecture. Okay. So much for the introduction, and I've at first explained what AJAX is not, and now I'm going to go a little bit into detail of what technological components AJAX is actually made of, if you can say that. So that is actually which technologies that are around are crucial for AJAX applications, and with which, if you are a developer or someone who builds such a web application, has ultimately to deal with. And now if you look at web technology and compare that to other information technology that was around before the web was invented, then you get the slightly awkward feeling. So it is like if you look at music and compare like pop music to opera. So in order to make pop music, it takes a mic and you go on the stage and you sing something with an electro guitar and you basically can do pop music. And in order to become an opera singer, it takes 15 years of education and a lot of talent before you can reasonably sing opera. And if I look at web application technology, then it strikes me that this is somehow similar. So, I mean, it looks like the real thing. I mean, you have specifications and you have languages and you have compliance to specification and you have releases and versions and all that stuff. And it all looks like real software engineering. But if you poke into the details, then it's somehow, you know, it's kind of pop software engineering. If you compare that to something like an operating system or a programming language or a compiler for a programming language like C++ or something. So, and okay, so that as an introduction to a brief discussion of what AJAX is technologically about. So first of it, well, I'm not going to mention HTML, of course. So because HTML makes the skeleton of what you are sending to the client. So that's all HTML, basically. So and now the interesting stuff is what you anchor within this HTML. So the first of this bunch of technologies is CSS. So that's it is called cascading style sheets, and that's basically the way to define your visual layout. And the thing is that CSS is very flexible and very sophisticated, and it has very complex visual rendering models. So something like collapsing margins and flow layout and all that stuff. But if you try to really nail down a layout with CSS, then you get hurt very quickly. So it is not only because of the cross-browser quirks that you have to deal with, to which I come also later, but also because CSS in itself is quite awkwardly specified. So for instance, just as an example, there is somewhere in the specification, there is a clause that says that things whose width cannot be determined are 250 pixels wide. And so things are 250 pixels wide is what CSS is going to tell you. But then you have a very complex set of rules that determine how things look like, actually. And those happen to be contradictory because most of the time layout is done inside out. That is basically layout is defined as a set of boxes, and boxes contain something, and those boxes are contained in something else. And basically, you start to fill in your text into boxes, and those make a certain size, and everything else around is sized so that whatever is inside them fits in them. But then there's a mode that you can specify the size of boxes. And then suddenly, things that go inside the boxes start to acquire the size of the boxes in which they are. And there is no clear way, actually, to distinguish the two modes. And you can end up very quickly with situations that are actually contradictory and very difficult to figure out. So much for that. I don't want to go into more detail. Only, let's say, it is something like a CSS style or layout specification is something like, or the layout equivalent of a politician's election promise. So if you're familiar with... So something says like, read my lips, this color is going to be green, or something like that. Okay, the next big thing, and that's a very fundamental thing, is the document object model. And I'm going into the scripting language in a very short time. And the document object model is basically the programming interface to this HTML document that hosts your whole application. So that's basically the document object model is the library or the interface that lets you express whatever is visible to the user from your scripting language. So it is something like, if you consider the web as a platform, something tantamount to the operating system in native applications. So it's the most fundamental thing that you talk to from your programming language that implements your application. So, and now, look, I just excerpted some identifiers of properties from this node object that is the fundamental interface in the document object model from the specification. And I just want to point out a thing that strikes me as quite weird. So look at how these attributes are named. So, and those nodes have attributes that are called something like node name and node type and node value. And those are basically, because they represent HTML elements, tag names. So the node name of an HTML of a DOM node that represents an HTML element is stored in this property node name. The reason that it is just not called name, because it's on a node anyway, is that at the time the DOM was specified, the name was already taken in this context of browsers where this was going to be applied. So they called it node name. So then they called the type of the thing, which is element, or which can be element, or comment, or attribute, or document, and so on, is called node type. And some of these nodes have values. For instance, attribute nodes have values. And that's stored into this property node value. But now it starts to be bizarre, because a node also has a parent node. That is a node in which it is contained. But now the property that stores this is called... okay, I just said it, parent node, but all the other properties are prefixed with node. So, and you know, you have this node name, node type, node value, but then you don't have the node parent, but you have the parent node. And then you have, in this node, you have children, and these are stored in a property, in a collection called child nodes. Okay, so far so good, parent node, child nodes. And then nodes that happen to be elements have these things that are attributes. And attributes are also represented in the document object model as nodes. But then the collection that holds the nodes that represent the attributes is not called attribute nodes, as with children, sort of child nodes, but it's called attributes. Okay, so, and that might look very superficial. So, I mean, you might ask, why do we care? I mean, we know these names of the properties, and that's how it is. But still, I think that is very exemplary for the kind of attitude with which this specification was written. So it was just cooked up very quickly and very ad hoc, and they just made it work and made it look simple and look consistent and so on. But if you poke into the details, then it looks like, why isn't that as coherent as you could imagine after you think twice about it. And on a more substantial level, maybe, what is really missing from the document object model is something very, very obviously necessary if you are going to specify user interaction and visual effects in this API, which is transactions. So you can, if you run on a page or in a web page, then you can't say within the document object model to do some change here and some change there and now show this. So if you change something here, then nobody guarantees you that this change will not show up immediately. That's basically one of the main things about Flash, for instance. So in Flash, you can do that. So you have really a frame, and you do specify what happens in this frame, which is a frame in the sense of a timeline. And then you can show this atomically, and you can do real animation. And in the document object model, it's really shaky. So if you have to do something that has to move synchronously, it can always flicker or not, you don't know. And it's also browser-dependent, of course. And what is also unspecified, which is a very fundamental thing in the document object model, is partial deserialization. So this sounds awkward, but it's something that happens very often in web pages, actually. So if a web page is halfway read, it is unspecified how the document object model of this page looks like. But people who write web applications regularly access such unspecified document object model data structures. So if you have a page and a script that is embedded, and this script actually directly accesses an element in the page using getElementById or something, then it is actually very generous of the browser to do something reasonable at that point. Because if you look at the data structures that are defined by the document object model and all these bidirectional links, like between child nodes and parent nodes, for instance, then it becomes apparently very quickly that it's actually unclear what happens, how the document object model of a half document looks like. And in fact, in Internet Explorer, there's something that is considered a bug, but at this time, I think you really can't blame Internet Explorer or Microsoft that much for it. There's this well-known bug that if you execute script inside a table data or inside a table, then the whole document goes away and an error message is shown instead that has very little to do with what actually was wrong, as usual on Microsoft error messages. So that happens, so if you try to access the DOM from inside a half-read table, this just doesn't work in Internet Explorer. So very many people are regularly burned by this, and it's not that surprising, because it's just unspecified by the very standard that they are trying to program against. I left out, of course, JavaScript. JavaScript is, of course, the central technology in this bunch of technologies that makes up AJAX. So, and JavaScript originally had a very bad reputation, and deservedly so. So it was also a programming language that was cooked up very, very quickly, in a hurry by one person. And for instance, it has this awkward feature of a semicolon insertion. So in this language, statements are separated by semicolons, but if a statement ends at the end of a line, then you can omit the semicolon. So you notice from in Java, for instance, statements are always separated by semicolons, but in JavaScript, they are only sometimes, and you can omit it. And apparently, this rule was introduced into the syntax in order to lure Visual Basic script programmers over to JavaScript or something. But this rule is actually a nightmare. So it's a syntactic nightmare, because you also have continued lines in that language. That is, a statement can extend over several lines. So in this, every line end in a statement can potentially be the end of a statement, and the next line can be the next statement. And there are situations in which this situation is ambiguous. So basically, the syntax of JavaScript is ambiguous with regard to this rule. So, and that's very nice to have as a fundamental technology of a very important architecture. So, and another thing is, for instance, that JavaScript, as implemented in web browsers, is single-threaded. That is, everything happens in a single thread. And if your JavaScript in a page takes a very long time to execute, then nothing else executes in this browser for a very long time, including all browser interactions with the browser Chrome, not only with the browser page. But that's actually nowhere really specified. So it just happens, you just happen to find out. And and that's also significant an example of the attitude behind this kind of technology. The last two components are briefly explained. That's HTTP. That's basically the transfer format, not only to transfer all these HTML to the client in the first place, but also to make these background connections to the server to update your current page that I mentioned earlier. And Again, the user, the programming interface that is used, or the programming interface for HTTP, is this obnoxious object XML HTTP request. And not only that, it hasn't anything to do with XML, except that it exposes the response as an XML document object model interface instead of as plain text if the response happens to be XML. But what is also very telling is the capitalization of this word. So, I mean, you have XML there, which is an acronym, and you have HTTP in there, which is an acronym, and one is spelled this way, and the other one is spelled the other way. And again, those might be just words, but, you know, it looks like telling. And last is you have to have a transfer data format. That is a data format that allows you to transfer complex and structured data back and forth between the client and the server in this background HTTP sessions. And it was mentioned more often than only here. You don't have to use XML for that. No, not at all. And particularly alluring to applications that are written in JavaScript and process all these data they receive in JavaScript are JavaScript object literals, which are just JavaScript expressions that you can evaluate into real Java objects using eval, and then you have a real JavaScript data structure, which is much less obnoxious to use than the document object model to the XML document that you probably could have received alternatively. And this, oh, by the way, JavaScript object literals are recently called JSON for JavaScript object notations. But it's just part of the effectively it's just part of the JavaScript syntax that you have literal expressions for objects. So much for that. And this sounds all really awful, right? And I'm going to argue now a little bit that this is all actually not as bad as it sounds, because what sounds so bad is actually good for us, because we have to deal with it, and what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, right? So, and there are a few important practical consequences of this client-side scripting background data transfer architecture to web applications. So, okay, that's my second point, actually. So, namely, this is the separation of, or well, another separation in the logic of your application. So, you have two clearly distinguished areas in which to implement your implementation. Now, this is this seems like a bad idea, actually. So, I mean, it has also been argued that it's actually a good idea to have the same programming language and the same data format everywhere in your application. But I think actually it's a good way, or it's a good idea to have these really separated. So you can implement your interaction logic completely independent from the rest of your application logic. And the two are really clearly separated because they are even written in different languages. So you can't just copy and paste from your applet into your JSP or into your template, for instance, because that just doesn't work. So one is JavaScript and the other is something else, Java presumably, or something still else. And so that makes a real clear cut between two very important areas of the application, which are connected by a very well-defined interface. So, and now let me just bring up this analogy of seamfulness. So seamlessness is a very highly valued buzzword in the field of IT and applications, actually. And everything that is capable of seamless integration is actually considered to be good. So if you can integrate something seamlessly, that's good for you. But now consider where these seams actually, or the seam analogy actually comes from. So it comes from clothing, right? So, and now, if you look what seams are doing for your clothing, then that's actually what most of the fashionable stuff about your clothing is about. So it's not just the material, but it's also the content, so it's also the form. So seams give form to your clothing. So, and seams are actually quite important. And it's actually good to have high quality seams in terms of shape, not only in terms of execution. So, and actually, seams are what makes your clothing valuable. And in the same way, I would like to argue that a good internal structure of your application is something that makes it really more valuable, and more valuable in the sense that it is more easily maintainable and more easily intelligible, or more intelligible, and so on, or just creates a higher quality application, because you don't provide a good external interface to the application, but also you have a clear another way of introducing clear and good internal interfaces in your application. And that's actually a good thing. The other thing is, I only alluded to it, cross-browser compatibility, of course. So apart from all these technologies being kind of, let me not say crap, but well, like sloppily and vaguely defined in themselves, it is not only this, but they are only also sloppily and vaguely implemented in different ways in different browsers and also with different bugs in different browsers. So, and this is actually horrible. So you usually spend a lot of time to do cross-browser compatibility for your web application. But the good thing about it is that it actually forces you to do or to create good libraries, because you are really forced to build a set of fundamental applications to encapsulate these cross-browser dependencies. And it's the same thing as migrating code from your servlet to your template, which is good if you can't do it. It is just the same if you are basically forced to really carefully encapsulate all the low-level stuff and formulate the high-level stuff or the high-level logic of your application in terms of those. So just to give you a brief example of that, here's some JavaScript code of a very central aspect of JavaScript programming on the client side, actually. Which is event registration. So I mentioned that interactive applications are driven by events. So and you have an event handling architecture, and basically an application is written in terms of a bunch of event handlers. And at the end, after you've specified all the event handlers, you enter the main event loop, and that's it. So an event handler registration is a very important part of your application. So it's basically the basic, provides the basic plumbing. And not surprisingly, event registration is done in three different ways in all the different browsers. And if you look at the second, third, and fourth section, these three else statements in this part of code, then you see the three different ways to register event handlers in the document object model in JavaScript, which is using a method called addEventListener, which is the official W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium way of doing it. Then there is, of course, a way of doing it in Internet Explorer, which is using this method called attachEvent. And then there's an old-style way that predates the specification of the World Wide Web Consortium and also the implementation in Internet Explorer, which is this assignment to properties called on and the event name, something like onClick and onSubmit and so on. So far for this. And in order to register your event handlers, you always want to use this kind of function. You never want to execute addEventListener or something directly in your code, because you can't do it cross-browser compatible. Instead, you want to use something like this function EV that registers an event handler on a node for a given event. So and now, please notice the first section, so the first if statement on this. And this is about not cross-browser compatibility in terms of different interfaces, but cross-browser compatibility in terms of different bugs in different browsers. And this is really obnoxious. So it turns out that Safari, the browser, implements this addEventListener interface. So usually register your events using addEventListener. However, there is this event called DoubleClick, so that is fired if you double-click, of course. So, and now it turns out that the event handler for the double-click event, you can't register using addEventListener in Safari. So that's just how it is. You have to assign to the onDoubleClick attribute of the node in order to handle this event. So and this is something you only want to find out once and never again. So and therefore, these libraries are a great way to just stuff all this crap that you discover about your browsers in, and then you're done, basically. So and you never care about that again. So much for what I mean by good libraries. Now let me lose a few more words about JavaScript. But I guess, yeah, I have to conclude. But just let me point out some of my favorite facts about JavaScript. So I mentioned already that JavaScript is reputedly not serious because of things like semicolon insertion and some of the other stuffs. like the multi-threading specification of the runtime or so, but it is really a very nifty programming language. So it's really a cute language. So it's dynamic, so it has custom objects, it has a rich set of literal expressions, such as object literals and regular expression literals. That is something, for instance, that you don't find in Java. And you have things like dynamic functions, so and function objects. So functions are objects in themselves, that is, they can maintain state across invocations. And functions can be dynamically created, and they can be closures. That is, they can be created and retain the local variable bindings of the scope in which they were created, which is a very nifty way of, for instance, creating event handlers and handling events and so on. And I'm not going to go into detail, although I actually prepared an example for that, but let me just point out that JavaScript has been called a Lisp with C syntax. So it is really very lispy what you can do. So that's very, very satisfying to do. And as a last thing, even the name of the language made sense at the time when it was invented. So because that was a time when Java was regarded as a great, in the first place, and great client-side technology. And so there was this concept of Java applets being embedded in HTML pages and running there. And JavaScript was invented as a plumbing to make different Java applets in the same page talk to each other or configure those applets and so on. So JavaScript was not meant to be a scripting version of Java, which it is decidedly not because of the existence of things that don't exist in Java at all, such as closures and particularly closures and function objects. But it was invented as a way to script Java, and that's really what it is and what it made sense. Okay, so much for that. So don't be afraid of JavaScript. JavaScript is really a nice language, and it's not as bad as Java, for instance, in case you have doubts about that. Okay. I'm not going to show you these details or these examples that I provided, but just for the record, the reason why I wrote my slides in HTML... So the reason why I wrote my slides in HTML and not in Keynote was that I wanted to embed Google Maps into my slides. So, and Google Maps currently embed, at least without violations of the terms of service, only in HTML pages. So, and I just did that. So, I have these maps of this venue here in the page, and I just wanted to demonstrate you one nifty feature of this language, which is closures, and which is this creation of dynamic functions that retain the bindings of their current scope, so that you just, I find it always very, very important not to get the high-level overview, but also to see actual facts, because that's what life is about, after all. And let's see if I can show you this very quickly. So, that's a bit of JavaScript code. And that's actually a bit of JavaScript code that uses the Google Maps API. And it does just this, what we've just seen, namely embedding a Google Map into an HTML page. And I just want to point out one curiosity of in this code. So, and you see that we have, get an element into which we put the map, then we instantiate the map using new gmap, then we do some configuration of this gmap object, and finally, we actually create these event handlers and these links on top, at the bottom of the page for zooming out and zooming in. So we do that by assigning to the onClick property of these link elements that are in the page. So we assign to these onClick elements a function. So this function will be executed when the event occurs. So if I click on this link, then this function that I just created there will be executed. So if you look on the first function that I define, on this zo.onClick, then you see that this function takes the map object and calls the zoomTo method on this object. And now if you look farther up, then you see that the map object is defined in the second line of of this function that initializes the page, and that's a local variable. So and this local variable normally goes away after the function stops executing. So now, what happens after this function is, or after the flow of control left has left this function, is that we have installed this dynamically created function as the onClick handler of the link. And if we click on the link and this function is executed, then this initialization function of the page does not execute at all anymore. So it is gone. So, but still, if this function executes, it still finds this map object on which it calls the zoom to method. So what this means is that actually what here looks like one flow of control. So you have this code block, and then you have this function definition that again contains statements, is actually executed asynchronously later, but with the same local variable bindings. So and that's really very, very powerful. Although actually it turns out for some implementations it is too powerful, and if you do it like this, then this will create memory leaks in Internet Explorer, not surprisingly. So, and therefore you have to apply another idiom or pattern, which is called factory functions, which is a slight variation of the thing that reduces the scope, but which I'm not going to show you now. But anyway, these slides will be online, and you can look up that second example online. So now let me briefly conclude with four points that I just want to mention, which are basically the main challenges or outstanding challenges about the development of Ajax applications, which is, first of all, deployment. So, I mean, it's not a good idea for very large applications to just send JavaScript over to the client. You have to pre-process or do something about the JavaScript code. And you really want to have very good cache control in order to download your JavaScript code to the client only once or very rarely and so on. And that's not really sorted out yet. We do kind of nifty stuff in Google Maps. If you look at the implementation of the Maps API library, that looks very condensed already and it's not the original source code that we sent, but there's still something left to be done. The next thing is bookmarking and history. So all these Ajax applications should really very well integrate with the native interaction patterns of the web, which is bookmarking, that is maintaining a URL and pointing using a URL to a particular page, and history, browser history, that is going back and forward between different interaction states. And so far, you have to do that explicitly using some tricks, which are very well known, by the way, but which is still kind of unsatisfying that this is not really a fundamental functionality available to Ajax applications. Graceful degradation, of course. I mean, you still want to do something meaningful about people who only read HTML. Not going to say that. But the last thing I really care about is frameworks. And, or rather, the temptation to resist the temptation to build one. Because, after all, there is already a framework, only it is not called this way. It is called a browser. But the browser does for you exactly what a framework normally does. So it provides you, it runs the main event loop, it provides you the facilities to send events and to handle events, and it provides you to the vocabulary in which you implement the actions that are mapped to your events and in your event handlers. So, and that's why frameworks are so unsuccessful in terms of Ajax frameworks, or didn't catch on so far, because you actually don't need them. You need good libraries, but you don't need frameworks who basically replicate the functionality of the browser. Okay, so much for my conclusion.